evening to everybody. We'll start our class in just about 1 minute, picking up the discussion about God's justice that we commenced last week. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, good. How are you today?
I'm good. Naomi, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay, we got everything sorted out.
I'm here too. This is Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh. How are you today?
Pretty good.
Good.
Beautiful. -2 degrees here in Indiana.
-2, man. We thought we were getting low at 16 last night or so ago.
Wow. I think we're bathing in the sun compared to you guys.
Yeah, it's probably 70 where Naomi is.
I think that's about right. We have to say we're going to drive to the mountain this week to see the snow. We never see it here.
But you can come up here. We have probably, I'm going to guess, somewhere between 8 and 10 inches.
Oh, I would love to.
Yeah, the kids would have a ball with that. Okay,
our guys were out at, in fact, all of us were out at after midnight last night because we don't get blizzards very often, and so it was pretty fun.
So that is at the beginning of the tail end of a storm. I hear that we're supposed to be getting stuff out here in the east.
Yeah, it's the tail end for us, and now I think it's just going to stay cold for a while, and later in the week we're supposed to get another weak one, but I think this is the biggest hit we're going to get.
Wow. Okay. All right, so I had a chance to discuss with Rabbi Chait the questions that he had, Doug, and also Josh. So, let me just go over the questions that we originally had, and I don't think I'm going to post last week's. Because I was wrong on the point of, I think I was putting forward the idea that there has to be some penalty or some guilt actually when somebody gets pained. So The Rambam actually quotes that in the fifth theory on page 285, where he says that even when a person suffers pain in consequence of a thorn having entered his hand, although it is at once drawn out, it is a punishment that has been inflicted on him for some sin, the least and the least pleasure he enjoys is a reward for some good. All this is meted out by strict justice, as said in Scripture, all his ways are judgment. We are only ignorant of the workings of that judgment. Now, I'm not sure if he's saying that as part of the fifth theory, which is not his, because later on, he says in 286, my opinion on this principle of divine providence I will now explain to you. So, it would appear that that is not his position, that every single pain that you have is a punishment. That would seem to be what he's quoting when he says, this is our theory or that of our law. and he says, generally accepted by our sages, which also gives you an opening to the fact that he's saying it's not unanimous acceptance.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Am I right that he is saying on that fifth theory, because that point really did bother me when I read it, that it is, that apparently is generally accepted by the sages?
That's what he says, yes. He says, I will show you first the view expressed on the subject in our prophetical books and generally accepted by our sages. I will then give the opinion of some latter authors among us, and lastly, I will explain my own belief.
Yeah, when he gets around to his own belief, if I recall, he doesn't particularly address the every pain is a punishment question.
Right.
Kind of is silent on that.
He says, well, let me give you Rabbi Chait's answers.
Okay.
And then we can go back maybe to the Rambam and see. So I'm going to again withdraw what I said last week and defer to Rabbi Chait. And he said, let me just read the questions we had. We had questions, and I'll get to Josh's because I asked him specifically point blank about Josh's question that he wrote online. How was it that, you know, Cain and Abel, you know, they one was righteous in his sacrifice, right? That was Abel, and Cain was not. He didn't give the best of his flock. So God had accepted Abel's sacrifice, but he did not accept Cain's. And Cain rose up to attack Abel, and Abel was killed. And later on we find that when Cain can't accept the punishment, so then God protects him. So Josh's point was, a good point, that Cain is the one who did the act of murder, and he gets protection from God, whereas Abel seemed to have the... He was fine. He sacrificed the best of his crop, and yet he was killed. There was no intervention. So Rabbi Chase point, and we discussed a number of things. That was one. And also regarding the ten martyrs, I discussed with him. He also cited that there were many righteous people, many tzaddikim, as he put it, that were killed. And of course, the ten martyrs are part of them. And he also quoted a Gemara, a Talmudic source, at the end of Tractate Moed Katan. It says over there that there were two righteous people. One died very young, and one died very old. And the Gemara says over there that you see that a person's lifespan is mazel, meaning it's not something which is based on justice necessarily. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's based on something which is outside of our scope. Because Rabbi Chait did say that there are reasons, we just don't know them. And Maimonides does say that a number of times as well. He said regarding the ten martyrs that there, you see there, there must have been extenuating circumstances why this transpired. He also quoted in support of that, I think it's King David that says that your statutes are exceedingly deep. They're like, you know, the depths of the ocean. Meaning to say that man can't really penetrate through it. So it leaves us in a situation where we will not have the answers right now. Will the answers ever become known in the future? It seems in Malachi, just my own contribution to that, that because I did come across it, I was reading through some sources on this, and in Malachi chapter 3, so God says that, as far as in the future, this concept of justice will be known. It says in Malachi 3:13, excuse me, your words are harsh against me, says God. And then you say in your defense, what have we spoken? So God says, you have said vanities. You have said it is a vanity to worship God. What gain is there that we guard his commands and that we go before him in a subjugated fashion? And now you glorify those who are wicked and you build up those who do sin, that do evil. Even those who test God will escape. So that was the evil words that the Jews had spoke, and God was listening and saying that these are harsh words against him. Then God says, there's another group of people, two groups of people. This is Malachi 3:16. Then there spoke those who fear God, each man to his friend, and God inclined, and he listened, and he wrote them down in the book of remembrance before him, for those who fear God and those who ponder his name. And they will be to me, God says, on the day that I do salvation, and I'll have mercy upon them, like a man on his son that serves him. And then you will return and you will see the difference between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who worships God to the one who does not worship him. Because behold, the day comes, it'll be engulfed with flames. It'll burn like a oven, and all of those who have done wrongly and have sinned will be as straw, and it will ignite them on that day that will come. And there will be not left to them a root or a branch. And they will shine forth to them, to those who fear my name, a sun of charity, meaning a light or sun, shemesh tzedakah, meaning it's not really the sun, it would mean that their people will be illuminated with new truths. And it will have healing in its wings. Okay. He talks further and he says that the those who do wicked will be as ashes under the feet of the righteous. So he alludes over here that there will be information in the future that will answer this question, because people had the question back then, Malachi, the same question, that you see that the wicked are escaping and they're living in there and people are praising them. And what benefit is there to worship God? Because you see that the great lives are lived by those who are wicked. So I'm just contributing that the information seems to be at a certain point in the future. Maybe it's in the days of Mashiach that he's referring to, I'm not sure. But again, as Rabbi Chait said, that you see that there were, the Gemara talks about it, that there were great people and they didn't understand, there was no answer as to why one died earlier, one died later. Okay, so that was outside of the realm of our being able to answer. Regarding Cain and Abel, so Rabbi Shea explained, it was evidently that Abel was not at the point, he wasn't at the point that God would step in and save him from his brother. He says that's clear. And why did God protect Cain, who murdered his brother? Because he did repentance. He said, my sin is greater than I could bear. So he admitted his error, and therefore God stepped in, and now he related to him on a higher level. So that would answer your question, Josh.
What was the first part about why didn't he step in with Abel?
What was that again?
What was the first part he said about Abel?
That he wasn't saved from being killed by his brother because he wasn't on the a high enough level.
Okay.
And the reason why he did step in by Cain is because he did repentance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it is. I thought it was a very good source that he quoted regarding the. We see two people of great stature. One dies young, and one dies very old. And the Gemara concludes that they just don't have the answer why. And again, you know, quoting King David, that God's statutes are exceedingly deep, so they're beyond anything that man could really penetrate. It's such a, you know, the knowledge we have is so minuscule. So I had sent them a question, and I didn't get an answer back yet, but I was wondering whether events like these, and also, you know, going back to Abraham sacrificing his son, so mentioned over there, I think it's the Maimonides says that the point is to show how far man can go, or should go, in his love to God. So it's illustrating for mankind an essential point. In all these cases, like for example, also Rabbi Kiva, and he was one of the 10 martyrs, so I believe what it said over there is that he always wondered how he could fulfill what it says in the Shema, that you should love God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and all your might. So he wanted to know, how do you love God with all your soul? And now, as he was being brutally killed, he recognized, this is how. Even if they take your soul from you, even if they're killing you, you do not abandon what your mind knows to be true. And perhaps, knowing that he said that, and that is really a real Kiddush Hashem, that's a real sanctification of God's name, to show how far a person has, you know, a person has to be on such a level, of course, but these illustrations perhaps are necessary to show you that there's no reason ever to compromise your adherence to what your mind tells you is truth, and what is should be the greatest value. And even if a person is taking your soul, so a person tells you, for example, to bow down to this idol, or I'm going to kill you, so you must bow down. If they're trying to make you, they tell you to do this for sure in a case where it's public, and they want you to deny your religion, so you have to be killed, and you cannot violate it, you cannot bow down. Because part of it seemed to be the system being complete if there were not illustrations of this point that... You know, for example, like Job had questions as soon as he started having problems in life. So the point over there is that you may not understand what's going on, but you shouldn't question what is good because you start having problems. A scientist doesn't say 2 + 2 is no longer 4 when he can't figure out other equations. He knows what he knows. So it seems to be it is important to show how a person is capable. These illustrations teach how far a person can go in his commitment, and even to the point that he realizes that his physical life here is not the be-all and end-all of his existence. So I think that's an important lesson to come away with.
I have a few questions.
Yeah.
I learned somewhere that if you don't give up your life, if you don't martyr yourself, like it's not an avera, but it's like a mitzvah if you do it. I don't know if you heard that.
It depends on the case. I know for sure in the case where it's done publicly, and they tell you to, I think even the other, I think it's just the opposite, even if the other commands, you're told to, let's say, you know, eat non-kosher publicly in front of like 10 or more people in order to reject religion. I think even there too, there's the Kiddush Hashem, there's the sanctification of God's name by suffering death. I think the distinction is that in the cases where it's like the idolatry and adultery and murder, so those would be are even more strict. I have to go through it again. But if I'm not mistaken, I think it's even the other ones also. The other mitzvahs too. If the intent is to profane, you know, God's name and His Torah, and it's done publicly, I have to find the source. I'll look for it for you.
I might also.
But I don't think it's true that you can. I'll have to see again. You know, it's important to teach properly. So let me look it up first. Go ahead. What was that, Naomi?
I also figured. I mean, you know, I don't really like have any source for it, but since this Chiyat Amitim, if people's lives are cut short, I mean, you don't know. They can always come back. It seems like, you know, they can come back later and you know, complete have like a longer life. So you don't really know, even if a person dies young, you don't know if they're going to come back.
It's true also that we shouldn't be assessing their life just based on what we see here also. I mean, it could be Tchias Mesim, and it also could be the person reached a level of perfection already. So we shouldn't look at the fact that they died very young as being a loss necessarily. Again, that's for sure we can say that, you know, God is running everything with complete justice. We just don't understand. I mean, nothing escapes his justice.
So, Rabbi, did Rabbi Chait conclude that, first, I guess, two things. When you experience pain, that isn't necessarily punishment per the fifth theory here.
Right.
And two, that the just person or the righteous person as well as the unrighteous person could be swept away by the tornado that happens to show up.
That's right.
So everybody's under the laws of nature, but a person is on a high enough level may merit the intervention of divine providence.
Right. He also said that when, according to Maimonides, that when the person, even a righteous person, is not involved in studying, so then he's not under protection. That was an interesting new point, that the person, again, is not studying, if he's not in that state of mind, so then he's subject to more calamity than if he was in the state where he was involved in study at that point. So he says there could be no protection for the person at that point.
Is that... Are we talking about at that specific moment or in his general lifestyle?
Seems that specific moment. That was my understanding.
So you could have someone who is at a righteous level and is involved in learning, and then they take a break to go get a cup of coffee, and then they could be hit by a car.
That's what it sounds like, yes. I mean, there's something about when a person's involved that he is... there's more protection from it at that moment.
Okay. So it's not an absolute no protection, but there is more protection when you're involved in study.
Right.
And what's the source for that?
I'll have to get that. He just quoted Maimonides. He didn't give me the source.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
When you get to a stopping point, I have another question.
Okay, just want to look at one thing on Naomi's question. Let me see if I can...
I think Rabbi Mann said that if in the times like the times of Hanukkah when some nation is trying to abolish the Torah system, then it's a mitzvah to even in private to martyr yourself, even for not the big three.
Right.
Even if it's not just the three ones that you can't do in public, but even like in private, like any mitzvah, you'd have to martyr yourself.
Right, in the times of Shema, the times of oppression.
So make sure we understand that. You mean in a time when the Jewish people are being oppressed, it is a positive mitzvah, and in fact, one is obligated to kill oneself?
No, to do all the, even the smallest mitzvah? Because, like, normally, like, if somebody told you you can't eat, you have to eat non-kosher food or else I'm going to kill you, so you would have to eat the non-kosher food and you have to save your life. But in time when they're doing it in specifically the Tribal Polish Judaism, then even in private you would have to keep the mitzvot even if they would kill you. But you, no, not to kill yourself, but...
Yeah.
I see, and it would go beyond the basic three that normally fall under this.
I think so. I think that's what... A long time ago, I might have heard that it was like not an avera if you fail to do it. I think I'm not really sure about.
You hear it? It's in the laws of the fundamentals of Torah. Maimonides' laws. It's chapter 5, law 1. It goes through a few. Let's read them, so we can clarify this right here and now. The Hilchos Yesodis are the laws of the fundamentals of Torah, chapter 5, and it says as follows. The entire house of Israel is commanded on sanctifying God's great name. As it says, and I will be sanctified amongst the Bnei Israel, the Israelites. And we are warned that we should not profane his name. As it says, you should not profane my holy name. How is this? What is an expression of this law? When the idolaters rise up, and they coerce Jews to transgress one of any of the commands that are stated in the Torah, right? Meaning any one of the 613. Either you transgress it or we kill you. So Yavor, you have to transgress it, and you should not allow yourself to be killed, as it says. The commands, the mitzvos, which you should do them, which a person should do them and live by them. And my mind has explained, you should live by them and you should not die by them. So the first principle he says is that if you are coerced to violate a command, or you'll be killed, so you must violate and spare your own life. That's law number one. And he says, at the end of that law, he says, and if you allow yourself to be killed and you don't transgress, so then you're punishable with your soul. I mean, it's a tremendous sin if you don't look at the value of your life and you want to be a martyr in a case when you're not allowed to. Okay, that's clear?
Yeah.
Okay, second law. In what cases are we saying, are we applying this? This is only talking about the other commands of the Torah. So now he qualifies it. It's not applying to all 613. He says it applies to most of the commands, except for idolatry and adultery and murder. And these, but these three sins, if they tell you to transgress them, or you should be killed, you have to be killed and you're not allowed to transgress them. But now even this has a qualification. He says, but this is only in the case when the idolaters have at their interest, their own personal pleasure. I mean, what is their goal? They just want to have some pleasure, whatever it is. For example, that they force you to build a house on Shabbos or to cook some food. So he's deriving benefit from the house you're going to build for him on Shabbos, which you're not allowed to do. He tells you, build a house or cook me some food on Shabbos, and these are violations. So in these cases, you'd have to violate and not be killed, because the purpose is for his own pleasure, right? Or if he forces a woman to have intercourse, or similar cases where, again, the idolater is now forcing the person to sin for his own personal pleasure. So in those cases, you have to transgress all the laws except for the three, okay? Those three you can't. Go ahead, you got a question?
Yeah, so I'm confused about the qualifier at the end of Law 2 about the personal pleasure part. So if he's doing it only for his personal pleasure, like I want you to build it, well, building a house on Shabbos wouldn't be a violation of any of the three, would it?
Right, that's why you have to transgress and you don't get killed. You don't martyr yourself in that case. Right? You only martyr yourself in the case where it's one of the three. So even if we're talking about a situation where the idolater is just looking for his own benefit, so then you transgress all the laws of the Torah. You don't get yourself killed unless it's one of the three. But then he goes on. But if his intent is to make you transgress the Torah, and that's what his real objective, it's not for benefit, but he wants to see you violate the Torah. If it's done privately, and there's not there 10 other Jews, so again, transgress it, and don't be killed. Even in the case where he's trying to make you violate the Torah, the condition is there too you get killed, but only if it is it's done privately. But if he tells you to do it in front of 10 Jews, then even there you have to violate it. That means if he tells you to eat this piece of ham, in order, not for his pleasure, but he wants you to reject Torah by violating the laws of kashrus, and it's in front of 10 other Jews, so even there you must be killed. And he says again, and he concludes his law, even if his intent is not to have you transgress except for any of the other mitzvahs, bilvad. Right? So that means anyone in the 613 in that case. If he's telling you to do it now, not for his benefit, but it's two conditions. He wants you to do it because he wants you to reject the Torah, and it's in front of 10 other people. Then you have to transgress.
Rabbi?
Well, let me just finish up because there's another qualification.
Okay.
But he says also, another qualifier, and this is Law 3. He says, and all these matters are not at the time of any gezerah. Alright, again, v'chol devar me'elo, all these matters, shelo b'shah gezerah. Al b'shah ha'gezerah, v'hu shi'amod melech rasha, but if it isn't a time of wicked decrees, and that is that a wicked king, like Nebuchadnezzar and his friends, right, and they make decrees on Israel to remove them from their religion, or any mitzvah, alright, so then you have to be killed and you cannot transgress it, even on any of the 613, whether it is public or not. So he says here, but if it's in a time of oppression, where there is a wicked nation out to remove us from our religion, so even if they tell you to break any one of the 613, right? Whether you're being forced amongst 10 other people or whether you're privately being forced to do it, right? So then you have to be killed. Okay? All right, so you had a question, Doug?
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure I understand the formula here. So on the second part of Law 2, if the person's intent is to make you transgress the Torah, if it's done privately and there aren't 10 other Jews there, you transgress and aren't killed. Is that true for all the 613, or only the 613 except for the three?
Yeah, just the 610.
Just the 610, okay.
Doesn't seem to be a case where those three you're ever allowed to violate. According to him, I don't see a case here where you're ever allowed to violate them.
So, if he wants to make you transgress the Torah by eating pork, and you've got an audience of 10 people, then he's saying you have to not eat it and be killed.
Right, if the intent is for you to transgress.
Right.
But isn't it, if you don't have an audience of 10 people, if they want to abolish Jewish laws, even if it's like in private?
That's right. That's law number three, where he says, but all these laws, when it's not in a time of any decree amongst the Jews. But if there is a decree amongst the Jews, for example, the king, like Nebuchadnezzar, right? Because he had told Daniel's three friends to bow down to an idol. So, if that was one, so if there is a case where it's evil decrees, and they want to remove Torah or even a mitzvah, even one mitzvah, you must be killed and you cannot transgress, even from any of the 613 laws, whether he's forcing you in front of 10 or privately. Alright? Bein ne'anas b'soch asar, whether you are forced, you are coerced in front of 10 people. Bein ne'anas b'eno l'veno d'cho, or whether he's just forcing you privately.
In front of 10 people applies to the three or?
The three does not seem to be anywhere where there's any question. Those seem to always be a case where you must be killed. Right? Because he says in the beginning, again, he says, all Jews are commanded on the sanctification of God's name. This is his great name. Okay? And you cannot profane God's name. And he says, what's the case? I was reading from the beginning again, for clarity's sake. What is the case? He says, when an idolater will force a Jew to violate any one of the commands that are stated in the Torah, or he should be killed, you must violate and you should save your life. You cannot be killed. Because the Torah says that you should do the mitzvahs and live by them. Maimonides says, this means what? It means live by them and do not die by them. Okay? But this is only talking about a case, now law 2, with the remaining 610, except for idolatry, adultery, and kill, and murder. But these three, if he tells you to transgress them or be killed, you have to be killed. But what case is he talking? When he just has intent for his own pleasure. Okay, like he tells you to build a house, or cook him some food, or he wants to just force a woman to have intercourse with him. Okay, so that's when you have to transgress and not be killed for those 610. But if his intent is that you should reject the Torah, if it is done privately, and there's no other people, right? So then you transgress. Okay, he transgresses. But if he tells you to do it in front of 10, then you have to be killed. Even if it's for anyone in the 613. Okay, so that means that only when there's 10 would you have to be giving up your life. Right, so there's two conditions. That is doing it not for... If it's for pleasure, it seems to be it's always the law that you must transgress. If he's doing it to make you violate the Torah, then you die only if there's 10 people present. And that's for any of the other 613 commands. But he says, but even this is only when it's not in the time of decrees. But if there are decrees, even if it's he's telling you to violate the Torah, any one of the 613. So in that case, Even if it's not in front of 10 people, you still have to die.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
So, this is in Maimonides' Laws and the Fundamentals of Torah. Does the, I guess, Jewish community or Jewry accept that Maimonides is the final word on this?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I do know that the Shulchan Aruch by Yosef Cairo, most of it is based on Maimonides.
Oh, okay.
That's my understanding.
So, I don't want to take you off track, but I want have some other questions circle around about Justice and Rabbi Tate.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
So going back to, I guess, the laws of nature thing, it sounds like, if I'm putting this all together, that we're saying that everybody's under the laws of nature. A person who reaches a certain level, and it may not be in steps, but according to Maimonides, it seems to be a spectrum of degrees, may be under God's special providence. But that doesn't necessarily mean that God will always protect them. It's not like a guarantee.
Right.
And so we don't really know whether, we can't know whether protection will be afforded in any particular circumstance, although it may be possible retrospectively for us to look back and have a reasonably strong idea that, gee, it looks like so-and-so was individually protected, kind of like we look at the story of Esther.
Right. As a matter of fact, there are words in the book of Daniel that support that exact point. Rabbi Chait did say that these are general rules. Like, what we were discussing, just to quote, because I put some, you know, points online on that forum that I wanted to take up. The question was, it says in Talmud Sabbath 55a, there is no death without sin and no punishment without transgression. And we also see that God saved Lot and Noah. We also had in Avos, somebody had mentioned to me, so I put it down here. Quote, it's Avos 4:14. So it says, it is not in our hands the suffering of the tzaddik or the peace of the wicked. Meaning, even in Ethics of the Fathers, the rabbis admitted, meaning it's not in our hands, it's not in our grasp to understand why certain righteous people have suffering and why certain wicked people have peace. It also says in the Psalms that there are seven problems that will befall the righteous, but he is saved from them all. That seems to be a different type of view. And it said in Talmud of Avodah Zarah that the righteous that receive some punishment aren't completely righteous. They had to have some sin. So all these things Rabbi Chait explained, that these are the general rules, meaning these are the general rules, meaning to what you're saying now, Doug. There are basic principles, and I was going to sort of just read through the verse here in Daniel. Let's see if I can find it quickly. So, Daniel, I think it's chapter 2, when they were being threatened to be thrown into the fire. So the three, Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah, they said, that it should be known to you, before you, O King, that our God can save us. All right, because they were being threatened to be thrown into the furnace unless they bowed down to the statue. But they said, where is it? Yeah, they said, I can't find the right of hand, but they said that you should know before you, O King, that our God can save us, but even if he doesn't, we will not bow down. So what they were saying was that they didn't have any security that they definitely were going to be saved. To this point. Meaning their position was at the very point that we don't know for sure what's going to happen. They were saved, of course.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So, then going back to Talmud, Sabbath 55a, there's no death without sin, no punishment without transgression. One of the things that I found troubling when I was reading Maimonides in theory was that he seems to equate any pain with punishment and vice versa. So he brings up the example there. If you get a thorn in your finger, well, that's punishment for some sin. And I found that one really problematic for a couple of reasons. And so I wanted to see, when we talk about no punishment without sin, how do we know when a person is getting a punishment? For example, you know, one could say, well, if I ended up in an automobile accident that was impossible for me to prevent, you know, totally came out of the blue, and I'm in pain in recovery, is that punishment? And if we say, well, pain is always punishment, then, well, what about a situation where I voluntarily go in for surgery to correct some, you know, problem? And if pain is equivalent to punishment, then in order to get all my punishments over, should I take a bunch of needles and, you know, hook myself in the arm to produce pain because somehow that's having some, you know, effect, if you see where I'm going?
Well, certainly self-inflicted pain is not what it's talking about.
Right. But sometimes, I mean, my understanding of the purpose of punishment is it's to correct behavior.
Correct.
But if I get some pain, and I have no idea what the cause is other than, I don't know, I tried to lift too heavy a box, or I fell off my bicycle, or whatever, then it would seem like the pain does no good at all in terms of punishment, because I don't ever figure out what it is I was supposed to fix.
Right.
So that made me wonder if punishment is not necessarily equivalent to pain, and that there must be some other method of figuring out what it means, otherwise it would seem to be random and worthless.
Well, I don't think when he says, according to the rabbi's view, and again, I don't think that's his view, but he says the rabbi's view that any thorn to the ends of your hand is for some wrongdoing, so it doesn't necessarily mean, that's just an illustration, it's an example. It doesn't have to be that type of a pain. It could be some other type of a pain. But again, I don't believe he's that's his view, because he says his view later on. So just to be clear, it seems to be your question is on the first view, which he even says is not even unanimously held.
Right. But when we talk about in Talmud Sabbath, when it says there's no punishment without transgression, I understand that statement from about a 30,000 foot view. I mean, it makes sense. On the other hand, what constitutes punishment? Because in this world, it seems like it's really difficult to tell punishment from consequences of natural actions. If you see my drift.
Right. You know, a person could be walking and he's careless and he puts his hand on a wooden banister and he gets a splinter.
Right.
I mean, that just has to be because of the, you know, like the physical world. That could be a physical world issue. He wasn't careful. He was careless.
So then, from a practical standpoint, is our approach that anytime we experience some pain, we need to at least look at our lives and say, okay, is there anything here that I'm doing that might be causing this, or something that I need to correct in my life? And if I can't figure it out, then I say, oh, okay, I guess this is laws of nature, and
The Talmud does say that. That a person has some problems, he should look and see if it's maybe he's not thinking, not praying properly, or if he's not learning enough. Definitely, if something negative happens, a person should reflect. That's what it says. I think it's a 5a in the Talmud Brachos. I mean, it's not the satisfying answer that we want to have be able to close the chapter on this, because evidently it's like King David said, you know, your statutes are the depths of the sea. The great depths to your ideas. So we're lucky when we gain, you know, one small step.
So if I circle this back then to one of the questions that originally I think prompted all this, when we look at the Mumbai massacre and the people who died, including Rabbi Holzberg and his wife and others, I mean, we don't know what's operating there, but it's certainly possible that despite, you know, his righteous deeds and whatever, he happened to be in a sort of the wrong place at the wrong time, and, you know, ended up with a kind of a horrible outcome.
Well, there may be a difference between saying wrong place or wrong time and saying that there's justice out there and we just don't know it. I think there is a difference, because the idea of being at the wrong place at the wrong time means that it was completely unavoidable. And it doesn't seem to smack from there being any justice going on at all. But, as Rabbi Chait said, we don't know what's going on, but God has to have a reason. And saying wrong place at wrong time seems to be taking it outside of it being under God's control. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and maybe the answer is, and this is the part I've been trying to reconcile, because when that event happened and I look at what this guy's doing and so forth, you know, it prompts the question, well, how could God allow something like that to happen for a man and his wife who appear to be, and others, who appear to be doing such righteous deeds? But at the same time, he seems to be experienced the consequence of a society that has allowed certain elements to be able to flourish and operate.
Right.
And that there are consequences of that for the society, and those consequences can devolve even upon what we would consider to be innocent people.
Right. So in that case, we just don't have the answer.
Right. And so it seems like from the way we look at it, it would appear that the righteous can be swept along with the wicked. And at the same time, there is a bigger system operating that we can't know.
Right.
Okay.
Piece in the mix here.
Yeah, just a little bit loud. You have to speak a little louder for some reason. I can't hear you too well.
Okay, probably my phone. Maimonides quotes this part again on, if you go to page 304 in the Friedlander, Guides to the Flex there, he says, like the second paragraph down, he says, for they say there is no death without sin and no affliction without transgression. And he goes on to say, every intelligent religious person should have this faith and should not ascribe any wrong to God who is far from it.
Right.
You must not assume that a person is innocent and perfect and does not deserve what has befallen him.
Right.
So, I don't know, I mean, it seems like maybe it doesn't say, I mean, it says you should not assume that a person is innocent and perfect. But I don't know if that totally rules out the possibility that the person may be innocent.
Yeah, the question is strengthened when we say children are killed, right? That strength is a question. Hey, what do you do in that case?
Right.
So that's why I think Reverend Chip was saying that these are general rules, and again, it's a difficult area, and these are general rules, and there's definitely a system. We just don't have all the answers. But I guess if you take a, you look across and maybe see how the people who are intelligent and righteous, how are they living today in the world? And how the people that are foolish and not, how are they living? You would see that the people who are intelligent, number one, they're working within the laws of nature. So intelligence will guide them to a correct way of living. And the person will hurt himself by making a foolish decision. So you'll see that that's just in terms of laws of nature. And the people who are intelligent too are much more at ease. They have happier lives because they're actually enjoying what God intended for man to enjoy. So they're really getting the most pleasure out of life. And people that are, you don't hear so many incidents like what happened with the Holzbergs. That's not the usual victims aren't the people that are really living properly. So he says over here. Let's see over here. He goes further. Let's read it. He says from the beginning. He says the doctrine of trials is open to great objections. It is in fact more exposed to objections than any other thing taught in Scripture. It is mentioned in Scripture 6 times, as I will show in this chapter. People have generally the notion that trials consist in afflictions and mishaps sent by God to man, not as punishments for past sins, but as giving opportunity for great reward. This principle is not mentioned in Scripture in plain language, and it is only in one of the 6 places referred to that the literal meaning conveys this notion. I will explain the meaning of that passage later on. The principle taught in Scripture is exactly the reverse, for it is said, quote, "He is a God of faithfulness, and there is no iniquity in him." So Maimonides means by that no iniquity in God means that he will not afflict a person who did not do something wrong. That would be a sinful thing. The teaching of our sages, although some of them approve this general belief concerning trials, is on the whole against it. I mean, the teaching of the sages is against this idea. For they say there is no death without sin and no affliction without transgression. That means a person has to deserve what happens to him. But again, as Rabbi Chait said, this is the general rule. There will be cases where we just don't have the answer. Maimonides goes on, every intelligent religious person should have this faith and should not ascribe any wrong to God who is far from it. He must not assume that a person is innocent and perfect and does not deserve what has befallen him. The trials mentioned in Scripture in the 6 passages seem to have been tests and experiments by which God desires to learn the intensity of the faith and devotion of a man or a nation. If this were the case, it would be very difficult to comprehend the object of the trials, and yet the sacrifice of Isaac seems to be a case of this kind. Of course, that God doesn't need to learn anything. Okay.
I wanted to say that it has to be general rules because we know that there's like 4 people that never sinned. So it also seems like the laws of nature and the whole system would take precedence over the individual. Because, I mean, it seems like it's just more important. And there's also like a lot of cases where people do things that are wrong and nothing happens to them. So it seems like it would have to be general and the laws of nature would take precedence.
Well, actually, the Talmud talks about a case where there's a metaphorical discussion with God, and it says, really, if a person goes ahead and steals a bag of wheat kernel seeds, and he plants them. So really, justice should demand that nothing should grow, because he stole this. Why should he benefit? But God says, no. What has to happen is the natural course of events will take place, but he will eventually have to pay the price in some way or other. But God's not going to suspend the laws of nature and stop these few kernels of wheat from taking root. No, he will grow wheat stalks, and he will eat from them, even though it was from stolen wheat. He says also, justice should demand that a person rapes another woman, that no baby should come from that union. Because then it'll be an act of adultery, so then the child is a mamzer, and he can't marry anybody. So what justice is there in that? But that's supposed to be a deterrent. But God says, no, nature will take its course, but the sinners will pay the price. That, I believe it is in the Sanhedrin, where he says that.
Can I ask who the four people were who didn't sin?
Yeah, it was King David's father, Jesse, Benjamin, the son of Jacob, Moses' father, Amram, and David's son, Kilaev. Yeah.
So, several of those at least were under the system of the 613.
Some of them.
David's father Jesse would have been.
Well, why would they all be under it?
Well, Moses' father Amram couldn't have been.
Oh, right. Okay.
But Binyamin.
Well, was he still alive?
Well, the point in the Talmud is not that they kept all 613, is that they never sinned. So whatever they had been obligated in their life, they didn't violate those laws. So I believe Maimonides says that Amram actually taught more ideas to the Jews while in Egypt. So there wasn't just the seven Noahide at that point. There were more that he taught. But if those were, it doesn't say.
And is it the Talmud that teaches that they never sinned?
Yeah, let me see if I can find it. Hold on.
Very interesting to know if they ever experienced physical pain in their lives.
Well, they all did die eventually.
Right.
So.
Because they didn't, like, they died for man, for other people's sins, but.
Yeah, it's Tractate Sabbath 55b at the top.
Sabbath 65b?
No, 55.
Sabbath 55b.
At the top. Yeah. The Benjamin, then Jacob, Amram, the father of Moses, Jesse, the father of David, and Kalev, the son of David.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, what it appears, and tell me if this seems off base, is this is a little bit like the Matrix, in that we see a certain set of events and things within our vision, and of course we have the Torah, and so we see certain cause and effect and we don't see cause and effect, and sometimes someone goes and from our viewpoint there may be divine providence on people who've reached a certain level that we're able to deduce, but beyond that we can't see anything. But if we had complete the same vision as God, if that were possible, then we would see a much bigger picture in this very intricate, beautiful system whereby everybody gets exactly in accordance with their actions. Is that...
Again, there has to be reasons. Rabbi Chait didn't go that far. We definitely can't even say that, you know, if we did have the same knowledge as God. That's just, you know, that statement is just impossible. Like Maimonides says, because then we would be God. So it's impossible. All we can say, I think Rabbi Chait said it well, is that there are reasons. God knows them, and we don't. And these rules at the Talmud, the whole digestus, are general rules, and this is what, you know, a person has to live by. And there are times we have to give up our life for, you know, the greater good of showing how far we are convinced and are attached to the good, that we don't want to set a wrong example for other people, and even in certain cases, when it's done privately, we have to sacrifice our lives and not violate. Which itself is a good question. But I think what comes out of this is that a person shouldn't be looking for personal gain when he's living according to the right system. I think this is a very important principle, just thinking out loud right now, that all the cases of you know, the martyrs, the 10 martyrs, and you know, these different cases that come up in life, we don't abandon living by what we know our mind that says is true, because we don't have answers in certain areas. Because we look at the Torah and we see all the commands and all the examples of the great people, the patriarchs and the prophets, and we see their dedication to truth. And this is really what it boils down to, is that a person in life cannot deny what his mind tells him is true, and he's really attracted to truth. And even if he doesn't have all the answers, so in general, the entire system is something which is, it really makes sense and appeals to a person's mind, and he's not living it in order to, I mean, the highest level is a person does the truth because it is the truth. He's not doing it because he'll get wealthy. He's not doing it because there'll be some earthly benefits. Then he's not really attached to the truth. We're designed in a way that the level, the highest level that we should be targeting, we should live on, is that when we realize something is true, is that we defend it, and we teach it, and we dispel fallacy, and you know, we sometimes risk certain discomforts for that, but we realize that living properly and educating people properly and not allowing people to be misled is crucial. It's interesting, you know, the law of learning Torah, which is the greatest, that Talmud says, the greatest mitzvah in the entire Torah, is Torah study. And it's interesting, I always found that the law, the source that we get this command from to the study, is not verbalized as "you shall study," but it's verbalized as "you should teach." Let me read it to you. He says, it's right at the beginning of the laws of Talmud Torah, the Maimonides. He says that the women and servants and children are exempt from learning Torah, but a son, the father, is obligated to teach him, as it says. And you should teach your children to speak them, I mean to speak the words of Torah. So you see, the formula is that you should teach them to your children. Which is, like I'm saying, it's why doesn't it just say that you have an obligation to learn? So that's really deduced from the command that you have to teach. But you see the emphasis is put on the act of teaching. Typically the Torah will tell you that you should take, you know, the four fruits on the holiday of Sukkot, so you should rest on the Sabbath. It's talking to the individual. What you should do. Here it's saying you should teach your children. Okay, it's not only your children, but it's your grandchildren. And he says, but not only that, but it's a command on every wise person of Israel to teach all the students of Torah, even though they're not his children. As it states, you should teach your children. And from the rabbis we learn, who are your children? These are the students of Torah. For students are called children. As it says, and they went out, the sons of the prophets. So evidently the sons of the prophets didn't mean their direct lineage, the direct seed. They meant the students of the prophets. Okay, so it is an interesting thing that the formula of learning really is structured as the act of teaching. Okay.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a good question. Why is it that way? Because it seems to be that the mitzvah of Torah is for the nation. So it's formulated in the model of transmission, not in the model of personal study. Teaching, that it really is it's a principle of transmission. It's not an individual act that you must put on tefillin, you must wear tzitzis, you must wave the lulav. It's a principle that this should be something which is transmitted. The study of Torah is really part of the obligation to the nation. And that's why it doesn't matter whether it's your own son or it's somebody else. And he says, further in Law 8, any man of Israel is obligated in study of Torah, whether he's poor, whether he's rich, whether he's complete in his body, and whether he is afflicted with diseases, whether he is young, whether he's greatly old, that is, his energies have already escaped him. Even if he relies on the charity box, and he has to go around the doors and knock on doors to collect charity for himself, he too is obligated to study. Whether he's married and he has children, everybody has to establish time to study Torah, during the day and at night. As it says, you should accustom yourself day and night. And he says, great were the wise men of Israel, that from them there were people who were woodchoppers, or some were people who drew water. These were their livelihoods, you know, physical labor. Some of them were blind, and nonetheless, they involved themselves in the study of Torah, okay, during day and night. And they were the transmitters of the Torah, mouth to mouth, from Moses. And when are you obligated to learn Torah until? To the day you die. And he says, and as long as you're not learning, any time that you're not learning, you're involved in forgetting it. And then he goes in terms of a formula of what you should learn. So maybe that's the answer now. The reason why it's formulated as a teaching is because that's really the objective of the system. It's transmission for others. It's not a personal activity. You're learning in order to make sure you proliferate the system. And that's for the nation. All right?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. The command is not a simple thing. From here you see that you have to analyze the formulation of the command. All right, Josh, Doug, Cal, how are we doing? All right.
Yeah. We're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thursday being a national holiday, sometimes we do a class, so I'll keep you posted if we'll do something. Because I assume everybody is off from work, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Okay, so let me think about that. If there's any other questions, I guess we could show that on Sunday. And let's see if maybe we'll do something Thursday as well. All right, sounds good?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Rabbi.
Okay, thanks for all your questions. I think it really, we all contributed to, get to the bottom line as far as we can in this topic.
Yep, this is really an important one.
Yeah. All right, very good. All right, so if we do something on Thursday, I'll give you everybody a heads up. All right?
Okay. Best Hanukkah wishes to everybody.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.